Patrick Lipp is the Economic Development Director for the City of Valparaiso, and he and his staff have some big projects that are underway. And we'll talk at least about a couple of them here on Regionally Speaking today. A very exciting bike sharing program that the City of Valparaiso and Valparaiso University are getting involved in.
Yes, thank you. One of the focuses of our mayor has been on transportation of all various modes, and we have our bus service both locally as well as looking into Chicago, other modes of transportation. But the bike was something that we had spoken about previously, and one of the concerns of many communities is having to go out and actually buy the bikes, maintain the bikes, insure the bikes, and so that model would not fit for a community of our size. However, there's a company called Zaxter, and essentially it's a turnkey operation where they provide the bikes, they maintain the bikes, they insure the bikes, and essentially provides the residents of your community an opportunity to engage in bike share in similar ways as I'm sure your listeners have been in Chicago or Washington, D.C. or larger cities where they have a more vibrant a bike share program there. Essentially, Valpo will begin with 25 bikes throughout the city. There'll be about 6 to 7 bike rack locations strategically placed throughout the city. The starting date will be about April 15th of this year, so it's coming up pretty quickly. And you mentioned the partnership with VU. That's vital for the success of this program to have those students on campus utilize the bike. In my role as Economic Development Director, one of the holy grails I'm always after is to draw those students, those 4,400 students on campus to our downtown and to our retailers. And if you drive through Valpo, you oftentimes will see the students going eastward towards your Chipotles and your Targets and your Best Buys and whatnot. But we want to have them come in our direction, although we have other modes of transportation to bring them downtown. We think the bike will be another alternative for those students there. We also see the possible uses for others in our community. We do have the V-Line, like I mentioned to you. About 11,000 riders per month ride on the V-Line. And so as opposed, it's a nice sunny day, as opposed to taking the bus, possibly they may choose to take the a bike from point A to point B.
Now, there are a lot of opportunities that can be taken advantage of in the city if you just have the right transportation. And I can see why students at Valparaiso University, if they come in and maybe they have a car, maybe they don't. And if they do have a car, they don't want to have to spend too much on gasoline. And I can see why if there are things in downtown Valparaiso that students would be interested in, they ought to take advantage of those. And what better way to get them in there? And it's not that far of a trek, is to get them on a bicycle.
No, it's not. And actually, we refer to it as that last 4/10 of a mile. It's actually between our downtown and the western boundary of Valparaiso University, but 4/10 of a mile. And so it certainly is not insurmountable. And to your point there, trying to encourage the students, as well as the faculty and anyone else that would happen to be on the VU campus, to come down, as well as our residents. You and I discussed previously, Valpo now has a valet parking service for the restaurants in the evenings to help alleviate some of the parking challenges we have downtown. And so, for residents looking to come downtown and people to just park their bike on a rack and enjoy dinner or enjoy the downtown activities and then travel back home. Again, another opportunity to utilize a bike share as opposed to either their own bike or if they don't have a bike, not having to buy one.
I understand that this idea of a bike share program really originated with some studies that were done, in particular a group of Valparaiso High School students working with you and other people on this idea. Are they likely to be able to take advantage of such of a program as well, too, although it's primarily for Valparaiso University students?
Well, to answer your first question, you're correct in terms of the genesis of this. Every year, their pre-engineering class has a project that they participate in groups. And last year, the project focused on bike share or on a countywide basis. And so I and a couple other individuals were asked to come there and provide comments on the presentations. And that really got me and others thinking that, just based upon the presentations and the data that these students have put together, that this project might work. In fact, when we reached out to Zaxter's, they remembered a couple of students from Apple High School mm-hmm. that had called them to ask for information. And so certainly credit to be given to the Apple High School teacher and their students for kind of planting that seed to move this project forward there. As to uses, in talking to Zaxter's, they have about 150 communities throughout the United States that have their services there. The potential uses, the potential users are as diverse as you can imagine. In the university community, certainly the focus is more on the students. But I presume that there will be a year from now when we do our analysis to see if it's worthwhile to move to a second year and beyond, that we will review the data and we will find a user group or user areas that possibly we didn't even initially anticipate. And so we're excited to see how well the community adopts and utilizes this this bike share program.
We're talking with Patrick Lipp, who's the Economic Development Director for the City of Valparaiso, about the new bike sharing program that is going to be getting underway very soon. It's a cooperative venture between the city and Valparaiso University so that VU students will have a great opportunity to take advantage of bicycles to get from the edge of campus into downtown Valparaiso to enjoy the amenities that are there that maybe they aren't able to take care of because the fact that they'd have to drive, and of course then you're dealing with parking and the like. This is one way to avoid the parking problem. Is this program going to be a year-round affair when it gets started here, other than just the annual reviews?
Yes. In fact, in working with the Zaxter folks, as mentioned earlier, this is a turnkey operation, and they take care of the maintenance. And so that question came up. Certainly, if you're in a community further south where the temperatures don't get as crazy as they do in our neck of the woods, it's a lot easier to go year-round. But they encouraged it to be year-round for a couple reasons. One is that so that the potential user knows, regardless of the day, the time, or the hour, a bike will be there. And then secondly, as you and I are well aware, our temperatures in our area can fluctuate, and you can have a very, very nice January or February day where the bike use would be appropriate for that particular time. And so it will be the bikes will be available year round to the students as well as to the residents of the community. And again, hopefully we'll have a nice winter next year as we are having this year.
And we can only hope. I know one of the other projects I know that you and your staff there at the City of Valparaiso are working on is one that's come out in discussion just recently. It's taking advantage of a closed up factory building that used to be a very active place in Valparaiso and giving it a new purpose and a new home. Tell us about how you'd like to see the Chicago Dash project get involved with the ANCO building.
Correct. The Dash has been, of the many successes that we've experienced in Valparaiso, the Dash certainly ranks towards the tops of that. And you have to rewind back to 2007 and 2008, and again, with the leadership of our mayor, the focus and the vision was to bridge and have that connectivity with Chicago. There's no sense building a wall and not embracing the fact that we are within an hour's drive, if you will, of one of the largest economies, not only in the nation, but in the world. And so in 2007, we began the Dash commuter bus service to Chicago. At that point, it was two buses. We're now up to four buses. But 135 people per day take that bus and commute and work in downtown Chicago. To a certain degree, our success has created new challenges in that now the parking lot that was identified near the corner of Campbell and Lincoln Way is full. Anyone driving by past 6:30 on any morning, weekday morning, will not only see that parking lot full, but we'll also see parking spots along Lincoln Way also full with people utilizing the commuter bus there. And so we knew that we needed to identify a new, larger location, both for our current users, but moreover, as we add additional buses, there'll be a fifth bus added in 2018, and a sixth bus added in 2020. And so there are various proposals and various areas that we looked at. One of the goals was to have this connected to our downtown to have more potential users for the amenities you mentioned earlier in our downtown area. And so one area that's been a challenge for literally decades has been, as you referenced, the old ANCO wiper blade mm-hmm. building. It's a beautiful building from the outside and structurally quite sound. In fact, there's multiple buildings there. Some of your listeners may visit Homenclature, which is a business in one part of the building in that area there. But it has lacked some sort of a unifying theme or unifying use, if you will. There are various environmental challenges on the property as well, which I think has also contributed to the lack of any development or use beyond warehousing and things of that nature. And so working with our redevelopment commission, we identified that location as to where we will move the Dash parking as well as a bus depot from its current location on Campbell and Lincoln Way, south of the railroad tracks, if you will, to the ANCO building there. We're working with the owner and their attorneys to finalize that, but at the Redevelopment Commission's February meeting, they announced the intent to acquire that property and move forward.
I get the impression that even though that the ANCO building, the main part of the building is vacant, of course, and it may not be suitable for some uses, I guess there might be some use to portions of the building so that you wouldn't have to take the entire building down to create the parking spaces that you need.
Oh, correct. Yeah, right now, in terms of the available space, I believe we can put in excess of 300 spots, which more than doubles our current capacity, which is sufficient for current operations there. The current plan is to maintain as much, or retain, I should say, as much of the current buildings on the property as possible. You know, simply raising everything down is not the intent. I mean, just the architecture, the optics, there are some that have complained about the water tower, and you drive by, it's an old, rusty water tower, but it's structurally sound, and that might add to a nice feature or an amenity, optic amenity, if you will, in the eyes of the right developer on that. And so the current plan is for the Redevelopment Commission, working with the city, to put a parking lot in that particular area there, to have the bus depot and operations move down there. And then most likely we will, the excess property, put out for an RFP to get the best ideas as to how the rest of that property could be developed in the appropriate way. The benefit will be is right now there are environmental challenges and concerns. At the point when we're done with the property, we will have addressed those. And so I think once with that sort of black mark or black cloud taken off, if you will, I think you'll see more developers interested in providing their best ideas and acquiring the property.
And what kind of timetable would you like to be able to put into place here to have things moving along here if things work well and you've gotten the support for the purchase of the ANCO building to be able to do what you want to do?
Sure. It's pretty aggressive in terms of timing, and I don't want to speak too or assume too many facts, but essentially we hope to close on the property in the latter part of this spring. And the goal is to move the parking down from the Campbell-Lincoln Way area, if you will, down to ANCO this year. There is some additional utility work that needs to get done in a current parking lot, and so the timing couldn't be better. And so if all things work out well, the parking will move down at some point this summer or early fall. And then probably sometime in 2018, depending upon what IDEM and other agencies require us to do in the property to put it into condition where it could be then deemed clean for commercial use. Probably sometime in 2018, you could probably anticipate seeing our requests for proposals or requests for ideas to the public sector as to how the property would be developed. As things stand right now, it is very, very unlikely you would see residential development on that property, given the challenges there, but certainly a commercial use, a maker space, a co-working space, classrooms, things of that type of use might be consistent with the building.
I suppose too. That's because that's primarily because it was a factory, of course. There too, the zoning probably is still pretty much industrial or commercial, to be sure.
That's correct. Currently, the zoning is industrial. Obviously, when the proposed uses are accepted, we may need to tweak the zoning to accommodate that. Mm-hmm. But I'll also say that another goal has been for the city is to encourage downtown living. We've seen a couple projects completed in the last year of apartments and condos in our downtown area. Those buildings that do have living quarters or units on second floor are predominantly full. And so one of the goals of this project is that at some point there may be residential development, not on the ANCO property, but in spots nearby that would supplement and complement the DASH service. I'm sure your listeners are familiar with out in the western suburbs of Chicago, your Naperville, your Lyles, your Auroras, places where you have Metra's train stations. Not unusual to see old converted warehouses or buildings being converted into living units. And, you know, those commuters hop on the Metra, go down to Chicago, work, come back, and literally walk to their front door. And our hope would be is that with the DASH service and its ease of use, that we may see some of that development circling around, if you will, the ANCO property. But that's a couple of years out.
Well, it's something to look forward to, something to look forward to, maybe the possibility for some loft apartments or something in some of these building areas around the Chicago DASH area, in particular when Chicago DASH is able to move the parking lot, as you say, to a property there at the old ANCO plant sometime maybe yet this year. Patrick Lipp is the Economic Development Director for the City of Valparaiso, bringing us up to date on some major projects on not only what they want to do to be able to put in better and more expansive parking for Chicago DASH users as they commute to Chicago to work and home, as well as finding out the latest on the bike sharing program. It's getting underway. It's a project between the City of Valparaiso and Valparaiso University. Patrick, thank you for the updates, and we look forward to hearing more from you here in the near future.
Thanks, Chris. Appreciate your time.
What you're hearing right now is music from the Billy Foster Quartet, and the Billy Foster Quartet is going to be presenting a jazz history concert on the IU Northwest campus here later this month as part of the IU Northwest Black History Month activities. And with us to talk about this concert and some of the other activities as well, we have the Director of the Office of Diversity, Equity, and Multicultural Affairs at IU Northwest, James Wallace, with us. Mr. Wallace, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you for having me.
Well, give us an idea of some of the events, of course, have happened so far during the month, and this seems to be, I guess, the great musical celebration kind of climaxes of the month, does it not?
Yes, this is correct.
What was in coming up with the idea of creating this jazz history concert, where did the Billy Foster Quartet play into this, and what are they going to be presenting to the audience when they come to the Berglund Auditorium at the Savannah Center on Tuesday, February 28th?
Well, when we celebrate Black History Month, an important aspect of, you know, our country is our music, and jazz is a singularly American form of music, American contribution, and we certainly want to celebrate that. And it passes so many different genres, and it impacts so many other realms of music, so we wanted to celebrate that and have it on our campus. Billy Foster, who happens to teach music here on our campus, suggested that he can provide a historical, entertaining evening for our campus, and we said, well, why not?
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that it's interesting, and he's certainly appropriately been involved in jazz music. He's also been involved, of course, as a member of, for many, many years, the Valparaiso University Jazz Quartet, along with his colleagues that he had worked with over there. So I can see why he certainly can take a look at the history and bring something to the genre candy.
Oh, definitely, definitely. And the other members of his quartet are, you know, no less familiar to the region. Bruce Evans, he was a instructor also at Valpo and retired orchestra teacher in the Gary Community Schools. Lanny Turner, the percussionist, has also been around. Carl Cohen studied at Berkeley and at Indiana University as well. So, you know, all of them have a connection to the region. So we certainly want to celebrate their talents.
Tell us about some of the discussions that you've no doubt had with Billy on the types of music he's going to bring up. How is he going to look at each of these different eras of jazz music, going all the way back to New Orleans and working way through the years coming up to where we are today?
Well, he's going to, you know, start off with some of the New Orleans, as you mentioned, and talk about some of the free-flowing syncopated rhythms that they had back then, move into the bebop area with the smaller quartets and the faster pace and complex tunes, spend some time with hard bop as well with the smaller trios and quartets with the simple melodies and lots of repetition that comes there, move through the swing era, with his ballroom dancing style and large bands and, you know, not a lot of improvisation there. So he's going to share, you know, some of all of those genres of jazz and perform some of those pieces along with the vocalist, Renee Miles Foster, who's going to join them as well. And, not only share the styles, but then explain, you know, where some of this comes from and how it impacts the music that we listen to today.
Now, we know, obviously, that the people who have grown up with this music through the years are certainly very familiar with it, very appreciative of it. What do you hope that this jazz history concert that the Billy Foster Quartet will be able to bring to IU Northwest will be able to make a difference to help teach younger people, those maybe that aren't familiar with jazz or not familiar with some of these older genres?
Well, the exposure is always important. Being able to remember perhaps a more peaceful time in our nation's history and enjoy some of the music and remember what that was like and how the music has touched, you know, many lives through the years. I hope that our students will come to appreciate the history of that and where some of the foundations were laid for some of the music that they listen to today and maybe recognize some of the melodies that they may see popping up in some of the popular tunes that they are listening to today. So I hope they are able to make that connection.
I know that some people even say today that they even go back and they say they must know something within their own careers, singers especially, to even people like Billie Holiday. A lot of people have listened to Billie Holiday music. Even I understand Frank Sinatra, even when he was a young man, said he used to wear out the grooves of Billie Holiday records listening to how she happened to style songs, how she sold songs. And that in turn is how we know that many artists in the years after even Frank Sinatra into today, I suppose, have said that they owe something to the early jazz artists and in particular to people like Billie Holiday and Sarah Vaughan and other people as well that have been able to show their distinctive styles in jazz.
Indeed, these are all very important people who are worth remembering. And, you know, we take this opportunity to not only honor their memory, celebrate their legacies, but enjoy the music that they left behind.
We're talking with James Wallace. He's the director of the IU Northwest Office of Diversity, Equity, and Multicultural Affairs. As Black History Month winds down at the end of February, one of the great events coming up, not only talking history, but great music as well, too, is a jazz history concert that features the Billy Foster Quartet. It'll be at 6 o'clock in the evening on Tuesday, February 28th. At the Bruce Berglund Auditorium at the Savannah Center on the IU Northwest campus in Gary. You can check out the IU Northwest website to find out more, but just make plans to be there. It's a great concert that's open to everybody, and audience participation is encouraged. That's how it's put here on the information that you should take advantage of a chance to not only celebrate some Black history and in particular some jazz history as well, too, with a great group called the Billy Foster Quartet. Mr. Wallace, thank you very much for being with us to talk about this. We hope to get a great crowd for this event on Tuesday evening, the 28th, and we hope to see you there.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. Remember, this is free and it's open to the public.
That's right. It's very important. Here's a chance to take advantage of something on the IU Northwest campus on February 28th. And thank you very much, James Wallace, for being with us today.
Thank you again. Take care.
Thank you. The Lake County Sheriff and the County Council are at odds these days over the Sheriff's Department's budget. Council says that for the past nearly 4 years, the Sheriff's budget has gone way over budget, and they want to know why. Lakeshore Public Radio's Stephen Lattimore reports at this week's council meeting, a new oversight committee was created to figure out why and come up with solutions.
The Lake County Council has a problem with the way the Lake County Sheriff is running his department. Every year for the past 3 years, the Sheriff's Department has gone over budget. The result is the council has to take money from the current year's budget to cover bills from last year. Ted Bilski is president of the Lake County Council.
I'm of the opinion, obviously in the minority of the opinion, that regardless that bill is going to need to be paid. So whether we prolong that till next month or we paid it today, if we prolong it till next month, I'm of the opinion that it just puts more harm and reproach on that particular vendor who in good faith provided service expecting payment in a timely fashion. I would say it's frustration. It's just trying to get a handle on the spending.
So far this year, the Sheriff's Department is over about $200,000 because of unpaid bills from last year. Jamal Washington is councilman from District 3. Washington introduced an ordinance to create an oversight panel that would look into why the bills are coming in so late. The measure was approved.
Over the last 4 years, we almost had $11 million, either from paying last year bills or additional appropriations. Right now, we're sitting in February. He's asked for almost $200,000 in February. You know, that trend is going to go another million to $2 million this year. So, yes, I asked for an investigative committee so we can come together and use our subpoena powers and get the information we need to find out where the drop-off is. You know, is it something that we're doing? Is it the vendors? Or is it something that the Sheriff's Department is doing? You know, that $11 million is going over their budget, $11 million. That could be road repair. That can be different ventures out here in the public. That can be raises. It can be a lot of things. It can be insurance payments. We just did a bond for $9 million. It cost the citizens about $80 a year. If the sheriff would have stayed over his budget, we wouldn't need the bond.
Eldon Strong is councilman from District 7. He supported the new oversight committee.
And repeatedly, it seems annually, the sheriff is always coming after us for more money. We've always accommodated him. But these late bills that come in that we're paying from 2016, in this case paying in 2017, we continue to do that. All that does is just eat a hole in this current year's budget, in this case 2017. We did it in 2015. You know, we're paying 2016 bills in 2015. We're paying 2017 bills in 2016. If we continue to do that, we're never going to get ahead. It's not a budget. It's not a budget. A budget is the amount of money they give you and you live within your means and that's how it works. But if you do this, I use the analogy of we're digging a hole and we're not even throwing the dirt out. We're just throwing the dirt straight up. We're not here to give the sheriff grief. That's not the intent. What we're here is to find out why we continually are running behind budget all the time.
The full council voted to hold off on paying any new bills from the Sheriff's Department until the next council meeting. In Crown Point, Stephen Lattimore, Lakeshore Public Radio.
And here's the latest in the budget story. Bunsich told the Times that food vendors stopped making deliveries to the county jail because they aren't getting paid. He says the cooks have a supply of less than 10 days on hand. And Ted Bilski said he is calling for a special council meeting to be held on Tuesday afternoon to deal with the crisis. And he said to the Times that he hopes that vendors resubmit their bills. In recent weeks, we have learned about the fact that St. Joseph College in Rensselaer is going to close its doors. And starting in here for the next school year, they basically will be dark, except for having to keep the lights on and keep the buildings warm nominally. But there will be no students taking classes there. They're right now trying to arrange for the students who are attending St. Joe's College to be able to find a class someplace else. And also in the meantime, the area media, including the Lafayette Journal and Courier, have been doing stories about St. Joseph College, the finding out the problems that led to the massive debt and why all of a sudden the school has to close. Dave Banger is not only one of the editors, he's also a columnist for the JNC, and he is with us from the newsroom in Lafayette to talk about a recent column that he did and talking with some people. Dave, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking.
Thanks, Chris.
First off, give us an idea here of some background that you folks there in Lafayette have received from not only your fellow reporters, but also other people, too, as to some of the situation involving St. Joseph's College and why it seems that nobody seems to know what is going on.
Well, you know, and I credit a lot of this coverage to my colleague Megan Holden, who's done a lot of the legwork on this too.
Mm-hmm.
This really started back in November when the school got a note from the Higher Learning Commission that said that they were on the cusp of probation and their accreditation was in some trouble. They've known that for about a year, but November it got more serious, On January 25th, the president of the college sent around a note to alumni and to faculty and students and staff that basically said they were in dire straits financially, which was a big part of what the Higher Learning Commission was dinging the school on, and said that if they didn't get $20 million committed by June 1st and long-term $100 million, which was a little more vague, that the school was going to have to make some changes. They came back on February 3rd, which was 9 or 10 days later, and the trustees had met for 2 days, had an announcement at 5 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, and they just said, well, we've decided that we're going to close for a year, which was a temporary close, and re-engineer the entire college and the approach to the college. They did keep open the St. Elizabeth St. Elizabeth Hospital tie for the nursing program here in Lafayette. But otherwise, they said, we are closing for next year. And that's kind of the baseline.
Obviously, students should be, right, and if they aren't already, should rightfully be concerned. They're probably scrambling right now, hopefully being able to take advantage of what is being offered by other universities like Purdue and even as far away as Fort Wayne and other cities outside of the area to help get them into classes so they can continue their education. Parents not very happy about this either, and I know that you quote in one of your recent columns about comments that I guess some folks had to say about the closing, some parents not happy, and they're probably just as perplexed or maybe more so than the students might be. Tell us about some of the reaction that you've heard from not only students but also parents of students.
Well, the students are rightfully upset and trying to figure out what is happening. When they met with the head trustee and the president on the Monday after that February 3rd, they had a session.
Mm-hmm.
Students just really ripped into them and trying to figure out, you know, how did this happen? How did we not know this was this big of a problem? The president here, Robert Pastore, has basically been saying, I've been giving you these signals since I came here in 2015. I did a column that talked to the mayor of Rensselaer, talked to a faculty member who is part of the finance committee up there, and students and alumni who basically said, you know, we got all those letters and none of them said to us, we are in a position of having to close. So that's been a lot of the anger, people putting together, you know, what were the clues that we had and what were the clues that we didn't have. That's mm-hmm. been a big part of this story. Now, the student, you're all right that there are a number of schools, including Purdue, IU, Evansville, Marion University down in Indianapolis, all over the state and beyond, who have offered these teach-out or at least opportunity to do this teach out, so people can juniors can go and try to get their St. Joe's degree somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
But the students I've talked to are all in the position of having to transfer, trying to get their coursework done right now, and decide: do I want a diploma with St. Joe's on it if it's going to be unaccredited at some point and permanently closed, or do I want to spend another year at, say, Purdue and just get a Purdue degree? Even though that's going to cost me, what's a year at Purdue cost? $16,000
yeah,
by the time you get done with everything.
Right.
And a lot of these guys are, you know, they're in a private school now where the tuition is way more than that, and are used to St. Joe's that gives about 60% of scholarship money and student aid. That brings the cost down considerably, but will they be able to do that? And will they be able to do that at St. Mary's or at Evansville or at Marion University? So they're all concerned about that. The other story there, too, is a lot of roughly half of the students at St. Joe's play sports. So will they have a chance to finish with roster spots at some of these other schools, or is that just gone by the wayside? And now parents are involved. You know, they're trying to figure out, you know, can we afford an extra year of school? There's tons of dominoes here that we're still chasing.
Dave Banger is a columnist for the Lafayette Journal and Courier, who, along with his colleague Megan Holder, who covers higher education for the newspaper, have been trying to keep an eye and trying to help figure things out of what's happening at St. Joseph's College in Rensselaer. I should mention, too, that I am trying to have an opportunity to talk with President Pasteur as well, to ask some questions of him, to get more details. We also know, too, Dave, that the university has put out on their website some information with the frequently asked questions section that I guess ostensibly will try to explain to the general public, whoever looks at the website for that matter, what is going on, what are all the problems that have come about that have led to this one-year closing and the re-engineering, as the president's calling it. But it's not sure it's answering very many questions, is it?
It's answering a lot of questions. It's giving bits and pieces of what the college is trying to say. Mm-hmm. It's been a moving target to a certain extent. And the latest story is that the group of alumni that has aligned themselves in this Involved for Life, which was a St. Joe's College motto and mantra anyway, they have come together and this week have decided they're going to try to raise $20 million, which was the number that President Pasteur put out. And if they can do that, they will try to buy back the university from the current administration, getting rid of certain trustees and trying to figure out how they can save and salvage the college. Now, I've talked to some alumni also who are very skeptical about, at this point, who will be left. Faculty are already looking for jobs elsewhere. Students are already accepting other places to go. They've got a college fair, which is really pretty weird when you think about it. St. Joseph's is going to host a college fair. They have 70 colleges and universities on their own campus recruiting students later this week.
I hate to say this, Dave, but this almost sounds sort of like the vultures circling, and that sounds very cynical, but it does seem to be that way, doesn't it?
I really think that they have come out, and I think colleges and universities probably are salivating a little bit because these students are going to be good, number mm-hmm. one.
That's true. Yeah.
But number two, I think that they are, I think there's a sincere attempt to help. President Mitch Daniels at Purdue put out a letter almost immediately to St. Joe's that went out, and basically they call it concierge service, where they're going to come up and work with students who are interested and waiving admission fees and giving them some priority to get into the university, and trying to fit them with programs that help them complete their degrees. Purdue wouldn't be necessarily in a position to do that. They have record applications right now. They have their pick. Purdue is in a really enviable position right now. But I see that the universities are looking at these places and saying, what can we do to help? And along those lines, Daniels had a conversation with his own university senate before St. Joe's was being closed, and there were questions about how long can Purdue's tuition freeze last. And, faculty has had a lot of questions about that. And he basically said in front of their faculty, their university senate, don't fool yourself that, higher ed is easy. Just look at St. Joe's. And that's been kind of something they're watching as well. I think that everybody is there, maybe for their own reasons, but I think that a lot of colleges and universities are empathetic to the students, especially in this case, and they really need some empathy, if not sympathy.
Dave Bankert is a columnist and as well as one of the editors at Lafayette Journal and Courier, the newspaper that has been keeping an eye on what has been happening at St. Joseph College in Rensselaer since the official word came out, even a bit before, about the problems that in turn have led to the closing for 1 year of St. Joseph's College, with a lot of fallout, a lot of impact on people, students as well as family members and faculty that are going to be affected by this, even if it's just a one-year closing that's going to happen. Dave, thanks for taking time to talk about this, and we're looking forward to seeing more articles in the Journal and Courier website about this from you and from Megan Holder. Your colleague has been doing a lot of the work on this, and we appreciate all that, and we appreciate the time that you've taken to talk about this today.
Thanks for the call, Chris. Okay.
And the latest is that St. Joseph's College is going to lay off 36 employees beginning April 17th. Positions include 16 coaches, a director of major gifts, and several university support staff. And in turn, the Indiana Department of Workforce Development and its community partner, which is Workforce One Northwest Indiana, have activated the state's rapid response team to be able to help those affected employees. More cuts will come, according to the university. And the college is going to give 60-day notice for any future cuts that will come in the staff at St. Joseph's College. This is Regionally Speaking. Kyle Meredith talks with Josh Ritter on his plans for a new studio album and how he's testing his new music on the road on The Speed of Sound.
The Speed of Sound with Kyle Meredith.
Before Josh Ritter heads back into the studio to start recording his next album, he's road testing new material in front of a fan base always eager for his next pieces. It's not something most artists can get away with, but then again, Josh Ritter ain't most artists. I'm Kyle Meredith at The Speed of Sound.
Let's see where the night takes us. Let's see where the night goes.
Have you done these work in progress shows before? It seems like you've kind of done something similar in the past.
With Sermon on the Rock, while I was still working at the songs for that, I started playing a few solo shows and realized I wanted to play new stuff. So suddenly, following my mercurial temperament, I decided I would just play all new songs, and it was a real revelatory experience. It was exciting to play the new stuff. It was kind of a high wire act for me, and also a very educational one. I started to realize what songs were working in my mind. You know, you never really know what a song is going to do until you play it for someone else. Until then, it's sort of just a strange animal you've created, and you don't know what its capabilities are. And so it was really fun to kind of pull these songs finally out of the book where I wrote them down and put them out there and see what happened.
I've done it through the handle. I drink the cactus trees. Up here to pay your tails. Heals the color of conqueror.
Takes a very specific sort of artist, but even a more specific sort of fan base to be able to because so many artists feel so beholden to those old songs, like they have to play them.
From album to album, from song to song, no matter if it's new or old, you're sort of carrying a little flame from one song to the next during a show, or from one record to the next during a career, and luckily, whenever I'm writing, I try and preserve that flame, whatever the charm is that I carry from one to the next, and you know, that's sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, and for it to like really be an experience, you have to have a good fan base that trusts you, or a group of people that have like been with you and are willing to let you have that chance. You know, luckily I'm an artist with that as a career that I can do this, and I feel that your job is to be an explorer, you know, to like not to retread old ground for the sake of it because it's the terrain you're most comfortable with, but to take the opportunity that people are giving you by coming to your shows, by buying your records, and turn that into an exploration of new areas. That's what I think my primary responsibility is to myself and to my audience. And luckily, I have the trust of my audience and feel very fortunate for that.
Paul said to Petey, you gotta rock yourself a little harder.
You know, in the end, it's like their songs. And so, as Tom Waits says, they're just fun things to do with the air, you know? I think that's there's pressure to do it well for me. I put a lot of pressure on myself to perform the songs as I believe they deserve to be performed. But in the end, you know, being on stage is just a human act, and there's tons of room for messing up. And, you know, if it's done with good intent, that you can do nothing wrong, you know? There's plenty of room for kind of cynicism and despair. You know, certainly it's easy to look around and on certain days, just the smallest thing can set your world kind of in a darker spin. But really, the challenge in writing is for me to write with a nod towards the little light at the end of the tunnel. Mm-hmm. And like, I think that's always been the
a hard thing to do, you know. It's easy to tear things down, you know. And I think that the what we're seeing now is a political laziness that you know, is criminal. You know, this confirmation hearing now of Jeff Sessions are just one of those things. It's easy to tear down an edifice. It's like, you know, it's hard to like replace it with something that is kind and good. And I think that happens in songs. And you know, if you can find that in a song, it feels worthy of having been written. That doesn't mean that I believe music has to be Pollyannish, but I do believe that it has an ability to carry you places, you know, if there's a nod towards the light.
She asked, "Are you cursed?" He said, "I think that I'm cured." Then he kissed her and hoped that she'd forget that question.
I also wanted to bring up that you co-wrote Bob Weir's first solo record in forever. Are you doing any more of that, or is there any finite future plans that you're, you know, co-writing?
It opened up a whole new world of songs for me. You know, I was to have the chance to work on, like, you know, something that felt like an older, you know, form of like a song than I normally write, and to be able to work with somebody in a co-writing situation where I could send Bob a song and he would take it and kind of reimagine it, you know, even change the music altogether, was like an experience. You know, it's one that I like want to do more of, and I'm sure, as I work these days, that those opportunities are around, and they're super, super gratifying and really good for my own writing. Sometimes you just have to build up a good head of steam to kind of continue writing. And working with Bob on this was like opening up a tap,
yeah,
and just pouring. It felt so good.
We'll be looking out for the next Josh Ritter record just as soon as he's ready to give it to us. For more of my interviews, you can head to Facebook and Twitter at Kyle Meredith. And thanks to Chris Allman for co-producing and editing this episode. From the studios of WFPK in Louisville, Kentucky, I'm Kyle Meredith at The Speed of Sound.
Speed of Sound with Kyle Meredith can be heard on Tuesdays and Thursdays here on Regionally Speaking, and podcast of the show, by the way, on our website, the new website, lakeshorepublicradio.org/programs. On this week's Shelf Discovery, Kristen hunts for clues with a clever boy and his trusty robot in A.J. Lowe's Sherlock Sam and the Sinister Letters in Brazbasaw.
Head off to class with your friendly robot and brace yourself for mystery, because this week's Discovery takes the case with a kid detective. Thanks for tuning in to this week's Shelf Discovery. I'm your host, Kristen Dreyer Kramer, from nightsandweekends.com. When I was a kid, I enjoyed the mystery and suspense of Encyclopedia Brown books. But in the third Sherlock Sam mystery by writing duo A.J. Lowe, Sherlock Sam and the Sinister Letters in Brazbasaw, young mystery lovers get a little bit of culture with their whodunit, too. The story follows 10-year-old Sam, his robot sidekick, and their closest friends as they spend the week studying at Singapore's International School. They're excited to make new friends and learn about other cultures, but they also get caught up in a mystery. One of the students has been receiving threatening notes that he's supposed to deliver to his famous father. Fortunately, though, Sam and his friends are able to step in and watch for any suspicious behavior, as well as collect clues that will lead them to the guilty party. Now, this third Sherlock Sam novel is a fun-filled mystery for young readers. It's a short, easy read that puts kids in charge of solving an important case. And though the mystery is somewhat simple, it's not so simple that they figure it all out right away. Kids will also love the characters, from brainy Sam and his long-suffering robot to their supper club of friends and tag-alongs. Though the supporting characters aren't fully developed, they add their own perspectives to the case. But this is more than just another mystery for kids. This series is full of cultural touches that make it stand out. Sam lives in Singapore, and in this installment, he meets kids from various cultures at the International School. His experiences help expose readers to different cultures, and to aid in the process, the authors even offer a glossary of unfamiliar terms, and they throw in a few puzzles and activities to make it a fun-filled learning experience. But is it worth hunting for clues with this kid detective? On a scale of buy it, borrow it, or don't bother, I say borrow it. It's an entertaining way to introduce your favorite young readers to mysteries and to other cultures. And after the mystery is solved, readers are sure to seek out other books in the series, too. Well, it looks like we've come to the last page of this week's Shelf Discovery. Sherlock Sam and the Sinister Letters in Bras Basah by A.J. Lowe is 126 playfully puzzling pages long and is available from Andrews McNeil Publishing. For more information, along with show archives and even more reviews, visit shelfdiscovery.org and nightsandweekends.com. And feel free to send any questions, comments, or recommendations my way at books@shelfdiscovery.org. Until next time, wherever the week may take you, don't forget to bring a book.
Dedicated to helping busy readers wade through the shelves and shelves of options to discover books that are worth their often limited reading time, Shelf Discovery can be heard here on Thursdays on Regionally Speaking, as Kristen Dreyer-Kramer offers listeners a brief look inside the pages of a new book. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. On Monday, we have a best of Regionally Speaking for you on a holiday and back with you with a new show on Tuesday.